Cats have been living with humans for at least 8,000 years, and the domestic cat is the most popular pet in the world today, even more than dogs. Yet cats seem to maintain more of an aura of mystery than dogs. And here to help shed some light on what goes on inside a cat's head is John Bradshaw, the founding director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol, author of Cat Sense, which is published by Basic Books. Welcome to our show.
Good morning.
And we invite you, our listeners, also to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692 or leave a question on our show page at WMYC.org. Also, Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, John, are house cats descendants of big cats like tigers and lions and panthers, or were they always around?
Well, it does. The common ancestor, it does go right the way back. There was at some time, many millions of years ago, an ancestral cat, and its descendants include lions, tigers, the big cats, and then a lot of small cats, maybe 30 or 40 species, of which the domestic cat is just one. And interestingly, we think that the domestic cat or the ancestors of the domestic cat may actually have evolved in America, not in Europe or Asia, even though its living ancestors, the most closely related species, now only live in Africa, Europe, and Asia, only in the Old World. But maybe the Americans can, or America anyway, can claim the domestic cat as maybe one of its early products.
They crossed over the land bridge, the same land bridge that brought humans from Asia into the Americas?
That's right. They did it twice. The original ancestral cat is thought to have evolved somewhere in Asia, and then some of its descendants crossed over the land bridge into the Americas. And then many millions of years after that, some small cats crossed back again at another period of time when the land bridge existed, and eventually spread through back through Asia, going extinct in America, but spread back through Asia into Africa, and then became the ancestors many more thousands of years later of today's domestic cats.
Well, cats appear in Egyptian drawings and carvings, and most people would think that that's where they were first domesticated. Is that where the first domestic house cat comes from?
Well, that's the best evidence we have, is that's where cats first became pets. There is a little bit of evidence from before that, from the archaeology, but there's no real, really sound evidence that they were individually owned animals, as obviously pet cats are today. That seems to have started out in Egypt, say, 4,000, perhaps 5,000 years ago. But the cat's DNA tells us another story, which is that there was probably a relationship between cats and people going back probably another 5,000 years ago, so maybe between 8,000 and 10,000 years, where the early part of that relationship was really just one of a partnership rather than people thinking that they owned cats. The cats would come in, help us out with killing the mice that were eating our food stores, and then go back and do their own thing. And the idea of a cat as a pet is more recent.
So it was a development of agriculture where grain was grown and stored what attracted the mice and then attracted the cats?
Yes, in fact, the house mouse is thought to have actually evolved as a result of our initial storage of grain. House mouse kind of appears at about the same time that we humans started storing grains. I mean, they may have been just grains that we harvested in natural wheat fields rather than there being, you know, any kind of agriculture going on. It was just predating that, I think. But pretty soon afterwards, I mean, once you get a concentration of prey, then there are going to be some predators who are going to regard that as an easy meal. And it looks as though the Arabian wild cat is the most likely candidate, is the one that was best able to exploit that. Maybe just a little bit cleverer than some of the others in being able to work out not just how to catch the mice, but how to ingratiate themselves with the humans who owned the grain that was being eaten.
You write in your book that even though they ingratiate themselves, the domestic cat is actually much wilder than other domesticated animals. Wilder than dogs, surely, but pigs, horses, cows?
The way we look at it, the biologists look at it, is that that all those other animals, the horses, the pigs, the cows, their breeding is pretty much controlled by humans. I know there are wild horses in America and other parts of the world, but they are escaped for animals that have were originally, their ancestors were fully domesticated. So cats are the exception to this, because if you just take the ordinary alley cat, I'm not really talking here about Siamese or Persians or other pedigrees, but the ordinary alley cat is the product of it. When it was a kitten, its mother was probably owned, but its father might not have been, and certainly its mother would have chosen who its father was going to have been. So they're still making their own decisions about who their parent, who the parents are going to be, in a way that most of our other domesticated animals do not.
My guest is John Bradshaw, whose latest book is follow-up to his bestseller Dog Sense, is Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It is published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do cats have to be taught how to kill prey, or do they just instinctively know how? Does it matter when they're separated from their mothers?
They have the basics, I think, in their minds of how to do it. But it has to be put together. They have to learn how to put the whole thing together to make it work effectively. So if a kitten doesn't really encounter any live prey until it's grown up, then it will probably never be a very effective hunter. It'll have it in its mind that this is something it's supposed to do, but it won't know exactly how to do it, and certainly won't do it very well. You can see cat hunting behavior. Every time a pet cat plays with a toy, everything it's doing is the kinds of things that a wilder cat, a feral cat or whatever, would be doing when it was hunting for real. But it's not very well organized, you know, and it will just it will play, and then the toy will roll under a piece of furniture, and the cat will lose interest and go away. Whereas if it was a real mouse and a hunting cat, that contest would carry on.
Sometimes cats seem to torture their prey by playing with it instead of killing it. Do you know why they do that?
It's thought they do it because they are not very experienced and slightly concerned. I mean, most of the animals that cats prey on could at least do the cat some damage. They've got their own teeth, they've got their own claws, and clearly they're going to want to fight back. And cats will have had experiences where hunting has not been not very productive, but also it's been a slightly painful procedure. They get nipped on the paw or whatever. And so when they get to the point where they are wondering whether to continue hunting, and a cat that's not hungry will get to that point, they will very often kind of give up, but not completely. So it looks as if they're just kind of playing with the animal. I don't think the concept of torture is something that a cat can really hold on its mind. I think that's a human idea.
Dina from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yes, this is so fortuitous. Oh, I was walking back home last night from the theater. By the way, we saw Outside Mullingar, which was amazing. So refreshing. But we were talking about cats, and the discussion went to Israel, where when I was there recently, there's cats all over the streets of Israel. And my friend told me it's a way of combating the rodent problem. And I was wondering if you thought it would work here in Manhattan, because we have a horrible rodent problem. If we, too, could have cats roaming the streets here, would that work to solve that problem? I'm going to hang up and let you speak. Thanks. Bye.
Well, we do have feral cats, but they don't – I guess we haven't let them loose in our subway system.
I'm guessing – I mean, certainly in London in the sort of 17th, 18th – even 19th centuries, there were plenty of cats being kept specifically for the purpose of keeping the mice and rats down. It still happens in rural areas farmers will still have groups of cats that really they're not pets. They really are there to do a job of work. I think the problem nowadays is that we've become very sensitized to this idea that killing animals is wrong. And that if a human does it, that's wrong. But also if a cat does it, whereas of course to a cat, that's its what it thinks is the reason it's on this planet for. It's a hunting machine, and so we have a little bit of a dilemma there. Do we allow cats to carry on hunting because it's their nature, or do we indeed now that we don't think it's a good idea, try and find something else for them to do.
And there have been concerns about how many birds cats kill each year. Some people insist that cats be kept inside. Are they really that destructive to wildlife?
Well, there's no doubt that some cats are quite destructive, that they are they're killers. They're quite often, the ones I've come across have been cats which have had a bad start in life and have learned to hunt of necessity. And once they get that habit, it's difficult to shake off. They will want to carry on doing it. It's fixed in their minds that this is kind of how food it arrives. They may also be fed by their owners. They may actually reject the food the owners give them in extreme cases, and they're really fixated on the idea that this is what they're supposed to do. The amount of damage that they do, they kill a lot of animals, but whether they actually cause extinctions or even reductions in population of animals is much more debatable. Certainly here in the UK, it's now pretty much agreed that what we're looking at is, in the terms of the decline in some of our songbirds and some of our small mammals, which are real, but it's not really anything to do with cats. It's much more to do with habitat destruction and so on. And I think in the United States, the science says that pet cats in general, they may do some killing, but they don't cause any long-term problems, whereas feral cats are much more of a problem. They are inevitably going to be much more effective hunters than pet cats are. Whether those pet cats are kept indoors or out, even if those cats are allowed out. So a feral cat problem, I think, is one that really is it needs addressing.
Didn't the Catholic Church want to get rid of cats during the Middle Ages in Europe? Were they concerned about cats killing birds, or were there other issues, which I would imagine have to do with the fact that witches always seem to have a cat with them?
Yes, I think the depiction of cats as instruments of the devil, which was current in Europe through the Middle Ages, I think that stems from, or the historians think that stems from, the worship of cats in Egypt. I mean, the original popularity of the cat was in Egypt was very much embodied in some of their religious practices. They worshipped gods which originally took on the form of big cats, but then quite quickly became associated with small cats. And this kind of cat worship then spread to Greece and to Rome and became embedded in all sorts of cults, which were then classed as pagan by the Christian Church when the Christian Church became much more powerful in Europe. And so in as part of their attempts to drive out paganism and convert everyone to Christianity, the cat was demonized. It was said to be an instrument of the devil and so on, and particularly black cats, which, as you say, then became associated particularly with witchcraft. And that idea in itself spread over to the United States with the founding fathers of the United States. So you had the witch trials of Salem and so on. And it was only really in the 18th century in both countries, both the US and the UK, that cats began to become popular and fashionable once again. They had always, I think, been working animals on farms. I don't think there's any evidence that in a farming community anyone took a great deal of notice of cats being witches or whatever. They were useful. But in the towns, I think there was persecution.
Some cats love to go outside. Some of them are quite active. Others prefer never to go outside. Is this all a matter of how they've been brought up?
To a certain extent. I think the it's probably not a good idea to confine a cat indoors that has had a lot of outdoor access, especially during the early part of its life, when it's kind of forming its expectations of what the world is like and what it should be able to get from the world. But there are good arguments for keeping a cat indoors. They don't need a great deal of actual physical space. They're not particularly active animals. You're not talking about a sheepdog or a greyhound or anything here. We're talking about an animal which quite naturally likes to rest a lot of the time.
Sleeps pretty much all the day, or the only time they seem to get up is when we want them to sleep. Somewhere right before dawn.
Yeah, well, that's some cats for you. Yes, we recently did a TV show over here where we were able to track what cats were doing at night, And there were owners who were going, yeah, he goes to sleep on my feet at the foot of my bed every night. And when I wake up in the morning, he's there. And we were able to say, yeah, but for 6 hours in between that, he was out and about. He went out through the cat flap and he was meeting all the other neighborhood cats and going into their houses and doing all sorts of things, which they were completely oblivious of. So they are indeed sometimes nocturnal animals, sometimes dawn and dusk. They can be active pretty much any time of the day or night, in fact. They're very adaptable. And I think that's why one reason why they make very good pets.
My guest is John Bradshaw, Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. His latest book, his follow-up to his bestseller Dog Sense, is Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It is published by Basic Books. And we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. After we take a little break, you can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with John Bradshaw. His book, Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's published by Basic Books. Is there as much genetic diversity among cats as there is among dogs in terms of size, hairiness, shape, etc.?
Cats are a lot less dramatic than dogs in their size and shape. There are a few of the same variations you get. I mean, there is a cat variation of the dachshund with the short legs, which is called the munchkin. And there are the same sort of long hair versus short hair comparisons, that sort of thing. But we haven't been able to breed cats very much larger or very much smaller than the original ancestor. It seems to be really just the dog that has, and nobody quite knows why, that's enabled us to generate so many different shapes and sizes. And I think that's probably going to stay the way it is. I don't think we're going to find any very unusually shaped or sized cats in the future.
But the coloring's interesting. I've always heard that calico cats are always female, orange cats are usually male, white cats are always deaf, and often cats don't have the same coloring as their parents.
Well, there could be a couple of reasons why a litter of kittens might not look very much like their mother. One is that the mothers will, if allowed to, quite often mate with more than one male. So there may be more than one father represented in a litter, especially a larger litter. If the two fathers looked different, then you're going to get a really wide range of colors among the kittens. And then there are a few little myths about the coat colors. The majority of orange cats are male, but you can get a female. The reason is that the orange color is inherited on the Y chromosome, the one that on the X chromosome. So a male cat having only one X chromosome is much more likely to end up orange than a female, which will have to have two copies, one on each of her X chromosomes. So it's possible to get an orange female, but not very common. And the calico is what we over here call tortoiseshells. That's a very unusual type of genetics, because what you have there essentially is a cat with a kind of patchwork of two different skins, and part orange and part brown, so that there is one set of genes firing in some parts of the body and another set firing another part of the body in an unusual way. Normally you get either one or the other dominating over the whole surface, but in this case, that particular case, it dominates in different areas of the body, and you get that nice patchwork effect.
My guess, I'm taking a call now from Chris from Westchester. Hi, Chris.
How you doing, Leonard? I love the show. It's been a while since I've called in. Anyway, my wife and I got a cat that was started life. We lived in Brooklyn. She was a Brooklyn alley cat. We got him for my wife's friend, and she gave the cat to us because the cat was torturing her other older cat and her two-year-old daughter. Now, this cat is a really funky cat. She fetches paper balls and beer caps. She's super vocal with a million vocal variations. But the thing is this. She attacks my wife's leg frequently and viciously. She doesn't normally attack me that much. But another funny thing with her is she'll miss you when you're gone for even a couple hours. I put her on my lap. I pet her. And when she's done after 5 to 10 minutes, I start to walk away, she'll kind of gently attack my leg, but she viciously attacks my wife, but she always sleeps on my feet at night in bed, and when I listen to my stereo, she lays on my feet.
Well, obviously she loves you better, Chris. His is one of any number of things we've heard from listeners along these lines. Let me read a couple of others before you give us an answer. Aaron wrote this on Facebook. Is there any way to help an antisocial cat that hisses at people? He's very affectionate with the immediate family, but seems to hate everyone else, especially my in-laws. And that's one reason he says he would never get rid of him. Another listener says, I got a cat when it was very young, and it's scared of humans, hides all day, is not affectionate at all, and wonders if that's because it was taken away from its mother when it was too young.
Certainly, the early life of a kitten is absolutely crucial to the way it it sees the world and interacts with the world and reacts to things around it. For pretty much the rest of its life. I mean, it's not very different to, I guess, to children, but of course we can't reason with cats. We have to kind of accept them as they are. I think your caller the clue, I think, is in that the cat was originally an alley cat. What happens normally in when a kitten is being raised by its mother and by its owners is that it quickly finds out that biting, clawing, playing too roughly is all it'll start out as. That's not a good idea, and its mother will bash it with her paws and maybe even give it a little nip just to say, that's no way to behave. And so they very quickly learn that when you're playing, when you're socializing, that you can go a certain distance with physical contact, but there are some things which are going to be unpleasant for whoever you're interacting with, whether it's another cat or whether it's a person. And some kittens don't get that start. They don't get that training. And then once they get a little older, it's a little too late.
But don't some of them give up that kind of behavior? My brother has a Himalayan who was a biter when they first got him. In fact, they got him because he was a biter. And now he is just about the most laid-back cat you could ever imagine.
Sometimes that biting comes from a sense of insecurity and anxiety. And I think that would I'm not sure about a Himalayan because that's a pedigree animal, but certainly could easily happen with a pedigree cat, with a non-pedigree cat, with an alley cat that's not really had the right start in life. That it's going to feel anxious, and the way it expresses that anxiety is through a little bit of aggression. Now, if the cat calms down and really finds that life is good, and its anxiety levels drop, and we know that some cats really spend a lot of their time feeling quite anxious, if it learns that this is everything's fine and that their life is predictable and life is good, then it won't feel the need to do that anymore.
What about the ones that the listener wrote about that are scared of humans and hide all day and show no affection?
That's certainly the scared thing, I think, is actually a lot more common than it ought to be. But you get stories of people who say to their friends, "I've got this wonderful new cat," and none of their friends believe them because as soon as the friends come around, the cat disappears up and hides in a cupboard. That is commonplace, and it's probably due to a cat that hasn't had a great deal of socialization when it was very young, hasn't got used to the idea that there's more than two or three humans in the world, and that is luckily is reversible if you have the patience to do it, because a cat's natural instinct is to run away from things that it's not sure about. A dog will probably just kind of come up and sniff them and then maybe back off, but a cat just backs off. And so you have to kind of reverse that. There are tricks you can use to entice the cat out with a tasty bit of food, something the cat really likes. And then while the people it doesn't normally like are just in the room, but being very quiet. And then if you use the food treats to get the cat out and get them closer and closer to the people that they don't like, then eventually they'll probably discover that actually those people don't present any kind of threat, and they'll learn to relax a bit more.
Well, most dogs are more outgoing and openly affectionate than cats. How do cats show affection? Is rubbing against you a form of affectionate behavior?
It is.
And purring?
We know, yeah. We know that because this is the way that cat society is structured. The cats are not very sociable animals. So they're wild. The wild varieties are really not sociable at all. They live most of their lives on their own. And so it's almost certain that domestic cats evolved their ways of talking to one another and being sociable to one another during the time they've been associated with us, so just a few thousand years. So it's not a particularly rich repertoire of social signals, unlike a dog's, which, you know, a dog has probably 25 different kinds of body language alone that enables it to interact with us, whereas cats probably 3 or 4. So they're not as clever socially as dogs are, but they're clever enough. And the rubbing around the legs, that's something they do to one another when they like one another. Putting the tail upright just before they do that, that's a signal that originally evolved probably to, so that cats could signal to one another they like each other, and now they do it to us. And when the cat sits down and licks your hand when you're watching TV, what it's doing is exactly the same as it would do to another cat that it likes, which is to groom it. The cat just thinks it's grooming you, and it's not really a grooming in the sense of cleaning. It's grooming in the sense of a very social flow of interaction between you.
And what about purring? People usually assume that that's a sign of contentment. Is it?
Well, it's very often associated with contentment. You know, most cats, while they're purring, are content. But the science suggests that this is really just it's a signal. What the cat is saying is, I'm friendly towards you. I don't want you to get up. I don't want you to go away. Stay here and, you know, let's just curl up together. So naturally, one comes to think of all those things as being pleasurable. So, but the cat is not actually signaling that. And we know that because there are a couple of other circumstances where cats will purr. One is some cats will purr when they want feeding. They'll walk around the kitchen or wherever it is and make a kind of purr, which is a little bit more urgent sounding than the more relaxed one you get when it's on the cat's on your knee. But it is a purr, and it means I want some food. So that, again, it's demanding something or asking for something rather than just saying I'm happy. And then more extremely than that, you will hear cats purring sometimes when they're in great pain. A cat that's been struck by an automobile or something like that will nevertheless, when it gets to the veterinarian, purr. And, you know, that's a big shock to people who expect it. How can that be? Because, you know, cats only purr when they're happy. But again, it's the same signal. They're saying, you know, help me out here. I need some contact. I need some close attention because I can perceive myself as being in great trouble. So, again, it's a request rather than just an expression of emotion.
Now, you mentioned that house cats, common house cats, are different than some of the specific breeds. Are there certain breeds that are more likely to be affectionate or more likely to be trainable?
Siamese are certainly thought to be more trainable, and I'm not sure that they're more affectionate. I think they're more expressive.
Are they the poodles of cat world?
They're certainly the cleverest, or they seem to be the cleverest. A lot of people who have Siamese saying, oh, you know, we talk to each other, he's like a dog. Siamese are very vocal, of course, and so we like animals that make a noise. We like animals we can talk to, and so Siamese in that respect are very rewarding. I think you'll find many of the cats that have been trained to quite a high level, and you know, people say, oh, you can't train a cat, but of course you can. It's just a different set of techniques to training a dog. But many of the cats that have been trained to do all kinds of things have been Siamese. They seem to be more easy to take around to different places as well, less territorial perhaps than a standard alley cat. But I think in terms of affection, it's difficult to say. I mean, you can say that some cats are more demonstrative than others, in the same way you can say some people are more demonstrative about their affection, but you don't really know what's in their hearts.
John, we have just a few seconds left, but is playing with a cat important to its well-being?
I think it's very important, especially for an indoor cat, because what's going on in their heads when you're playing with them, if you've got a little toy mouse on the end of a piece of string, then the cat thinks it's hunting, and I think to play with an indoor cat in that way is releasing some of its instincts. It's allowing it to perform natural behavior that that for good reasons you probably don't want it to perform for real.
John Bradshaw's book is called Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being on today's Please Explain.
That's a great pleasure.